This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/book review.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, a conversation with novelist Scott Turow about his long-awaited sequel to Presumed Innocent.
And I looked at the post-it note, and I thought, oh, my God, Rusty Savage is the man who's sitting on that bed. And then I said, okay, but who's the woman?
The Times' legal reporter John Schwartz discusses his new children's book about the perils of being short.
The evidence that kids who are small especially end up with serious psychological problems because of it, as opposed to irritation, just isn't there.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. In 1987, Presumed Innocent by Scott Turow was published, one of the most acclaimed and best-selling crime novels ever. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for almost 2 years. And now, nearly a quarter century later, Mr. Turow has published a sequel. It's called Innocent, and it features some of the same great characters. It's reviewed on our cover by Terrence Rafferty, and review doesn't even seem the right verb for this rave. He praises Turow's cunning, intricate legal thriller, meticulously constructed, superbly paced. It's also a lovely novel, gripping and darkly self-reflective. I'm delighted that Scott Turow was here to talk about Innocent. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
Well, that must feel pretty good.
Yeah, it feels pretty good.
Look, you wrote a classic in 1987. Now you've written a sequel that may also be a classic. Why return to the story of Rusty Savage?
You know, for a long time, I said I would never do this. And I had two reasons. One, of course, when Presumed Innocent was published in 87.
Your first novel.
My first published novel. My fifth novel, however. There were four predecessors that never saw the light of day. I was still really finding my sea legs as a novelist. And I thought if I publish another Rusty Savage novel, I will build myself into a kind of telephone booth as a writer. And I was also afraid of competing with myself. I mean, this was an unimaginable success. I had dreamed of being a novelist my whole life, but never dared to think about being a best-selling novelist. And I was aware that a lot of the charm of Presumed Innocent was that it was a new spin on a courtroom novel. As Ecclesiastes said, you can't step in the same stream twice. So for, I would say, 18 years, I refused to do it.
And wrote a lot of other books instead.
I wrote a lot of other books, and I look at that shelf of books and feel good about what I did. About 5 years ago, I was on tour for the last full-blown novel I published, which is called Ordinary Heroes. And I began to get an inkling that I wanted to write about Rusty Savage again. It was just a thought. And around that same time, during a stop at home to sort of empty the suitcase, I wrote on a post-it note, because I was too busy to just put it in the computer file called Story Ideas, a man is sitting on a bed in which the dead body of a woman lies. When I would come home periodically, I'd move the post-it around on my desk. In, I think, October of 2005, your colleagues at the Times Magazine contacted me and asked me if I would be interested in writing a serialized novella for publication in the magazine. I had always had in mind a story about a judge who couldn't make up his mind about a case, and I knew it would never support a full-length novel. So I was delighted with this opportunity, and because I've traced the history of my characters forward, I knew that Rusty Savage was an appellate court judge. I toyed with the idea of perhaps making him the protagonist of what became Limitations. I turned around after a conversation with my agent, who clearly didn't think that was such a hot idea, and I looked at the post-it note, and I thought, oh, my God, Rusty Savage is the man who's sitting on that bed. And then I said, okay, but who's the woman?
And this will surprise readers of Presumed Innocent.
And I thought, That's Barbara. That's got to be Barbara, the wife from Presumed Innocent. Then the real questions begin, which is, okay, so what are they doing in a bed together? Is this an amorous reunion? Did they stay married? Is it possible they stayed married? Once I started asking myself that question, I was really off and running on that book.
And some characters from Presumed Innocent re-enter the stage.
Right. Most interesting to me was the figure of Tommy Malto, who was the sidekick prosecutor in Presumed Innocent and the guy who was falsely but very cleverly accused of framing Rusty Savage in the courtroom during the trial in Presumed Innocent. And Malto is a character I've written about several times before. He appears in four or five other books before Limitations, which was the novella that appeared in the Times magazine. He had been the prosecutor in another of my books called The Laws of Our Fathers. At the very end of the trial in that book, he gives a really interesting speech to the trial judge who's just declared a mistrial. And he basically says, do you think I don't know that the powers that be in my office sent me up here to lose this case? I know that, but I came up here every day anyway because, you know, that's who I am. And it spoke a lot to me about the fact that this guy's got more character than I gave him credit for and Presumed Innocent. So I was happy that I had made him the acting Kendall County prosecutor in Limitations because that meant, given the timing of Innocent, Tommy Malto was going to be on the scene again. I think most writers have the experience, especially when a book goes well, of having a character who sort of runs away with the book, who escapes the boundaries that you've imagined for him. And certainly in Innocent, it's Tommy Malto. I got up one morning in the way I do when I'm starting on a book, and I thought, oh, let's try Malto's point of view, because I couldn't figure out how to get out certain information without entering Malto's point of view. And what is now the second chapter of Innocent came out almost whole. I just found I was really interested in this guy and his growth and his change, which is obviously a counterpoint to Rusty, who is in some ways a man of the law, but in many ways a complete mystery to himself.
Scott, another change that's happened in the many years between the publication of these two novels is the way evidence is now gathered in criminal investigations. How did it look in the mid-80s, and how does it look today? What are some of the methodologies that didn't exist then that we have now?
Well, of course, the big evidentiary difference is DNA. I wrote Innocent to be a standalone novel, but there are some subtle jokes in interplay between the two novels. One of them, of course, is that had Rusty Savage been tried a couple of years later than 1986, which is the year of the trial in Presumed Innocent, his goose would have been cooked because of DNA, because, of course, it is Rusty's DNA that was found in the victim, Carolyn Polhemus. And that is but one of the many technological changes in evidence gathering. Innocent deals with computer forensics. It deals with toxicology, which is, of course, now much more sophisticated, and even fingerprint technology, which has become amazingly more discerning. But, you know, a lot of this is still an illusion. You know, you have the CSI effect in courtrooms where juries coming back and saying not guilty and, you know, what? I had four witnesses. What the hell was wrong with you? But there was no scientific evidence. We've watched CSI. There was no proof like that. So it's changed and not always for the better.
And what about the relationships within the legal universe that you describe so vividly? Have they changed as well, or is law practiced and criminal procedure and all the rest practiced more or less the way it was a quarter century ago?
Well, I don't think it's exactly the same. The criminal practice, though, which is where my life has been rooted, both as a prosecutor for 8 years and then as a defense lawyer, albeit one who's practiced part-time for many years now, that's a small enough world that people know that they're going to be coming around again in one another's lives. And so there's a certain fairness principle that has to apply because you can screw the guy this time, but 2 years from now, he's going to be back. or she's going to be back, and you better watch out. So I always say that the criminal bar is like living in a small town. And yes, there are changes. The sentencing guidelines have made a big difference. The U.S. Attorney's Office under my friend Pat Fitzgerald is a little more hard-nosed place, which I complain to him privately about from time to time. But it's pretty much the same kind of world it was. Beyond that, though, when you get into the world of civil litigation and big law firms, you're talking about changes that are, for the most part, lamentable. The money chase is more open than ever in the practice of law. I really don't think that's what being a lawyer is about. Now, it's easy for Turow to say that because, after all, he has another way to make a living. He's got a great gig going as a novelist. So, and I'm aware of that. So I make these criticisms with a realization that I am not in the same position as those I'm judging. But I still think being a lawyer is about having a part in trying to do justice, and doesn't work out a lot of the time, but it's still a really noble enterprise compared to, you know, the alternative of not trying at all. Too many lawyers lose their sense of alliance with those higher purposes, and that's a lot of what's happened in the last 25 years as firm profits have become the driving engine for a lot of what goes on in the practice of law.
Thanks a lot, Scott Turow.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Scott Turow, whose new novel, Innocent, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One book to consider is Every Day in Tuscany, Seasons of an Italian Life by Frances Mays, which is a follow-up to her widely acclaimed book, Under the Tuscan Sun. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
And now we welcome Julie Bossman, who is the publishing reporter for the New York Times and will be giving us notes from the field every week. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're on a new beat, and listeners and readers like to know, how do you do it? How do you learn about the publishing area you're going to be reporting on? Because at the Times, you jump right into it, right? There's no course you take. So how do you start? What's the first thing you've done?
Well, I've been on the phone a lot this week. I've been calling lots of people who work in all corners of the industry. I've been talking to publishers and publicists and editors and just trying to find out what's going on, what's new, what's coming around the corner. And everyone has a different perspective on it, so that's pretty much where I'm beginning at this point.
They have their own agendas, right?
Yeah.
Don't all people that reporters cover have agendas? What are some of the agendas you're picking up in a general way in publishing?
Well, actually, the thing that everyone is talking about right now is that they're in the fear stage. With the iPad that just came out, people are very concerned, frightened, worried about what's going to happen to the industry in the coming months. Are readers going to turn away from the physical book and turn to ebooks? What does that mean? How quickly will it happen? So it seems like there are just a ton of questions out there right now, and they're in sort of a wait and see moment.
And when you're doing this, Julie, you've done a lot of reporting for the paper. You've done politics, you've done national and metro reporting. When you talk to these people, are you kind of making a checklist to yourself of who might be a good source, who might be a reliable source of information for stories you're going to report down the line? Are you cultivating them to some extent?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that, you know, people I talk to, you know, I have many conversations with them, get to know them, find out, you know, what they think, and, you know, perhaps if they have a book that they want me to write about, that's fine too. But I think that, you know, like with any beat that you're covering, it comes down to relationships. And actually, this is a wonderful time to start on the beat because the Book Expo is coming up in 2 weeks.
Right, the huge annual
booksellers convention right here in New York.
The big monster booksellers convention, which actually this year is very condensed and it's not on the weekend. Apparently in previous years, it's always been on the weekend. So everyone in the publishing industry seems very excited about that element of it. So it'll be a bit of a hazing, I guess. I'll go to the convention and talk to as many people as I can and, you know, see what's percolating out there.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thank you.
Welcome.
John Schwartz is a national legal correspondent for the New York Times. He's also a great writer who's written a fun children's book. It's called Short, Walking Tall When You're Not Tall at All. It's reviewed for us by Jerry Griswold, who calls it an amusing book with laughs aplenty. I'm delighted John's here to talk about it. Welcome, John.
Thanks.
So you and I can pretty much look at each other eye to eye.
Yeah, I think you've got a little height on me, but I don't hold that against you.
That's not much. So tell us how you came to write this book. It's actually there's a serious argument in this book, and you should lay it out for us.
Well, in fact, the idea started in 2003 when the Food and Drug Administration gave approval to the use of human growth hormone for kids who are merely short. Before that, it had been approved for use for kids with a deficiency, dwarfism, or any of the conditions in which your body's not producing the hormone. And so getting a shot of hormone is actually going to have a big effect to bring these kids into the height range that's closer to normal.
And at what age, John, might this be administered? How young are the kids?
8, 10, 11, young. And so what you're doing for the short kids is anticipating how tall a child is likely to get. And what the FDA said in 2003 was, if a kid is not likely to get taller than 5'3", say, 1.2% of the population, then using the hormone's okay. We approve that. And to me, that sent a really unfortunate message, which is that if you're, say, going to be 5'3", which is my height, there's something wrong with you. There's something medically wrong with you. There's something that we can fix. And, you know, I kind of thought, I mean, I'd rather been taller, but I thought I was okay.
Well, what are some of the advantages of being short guys like us?
Well, we're brilliant, witty, and we get along in social situations, actually. My argument in the book is that because you can't just roll over people, because you're not the captain of the football team, that socially you have to adapt. And that process of adapting does have a way of making people a little more verbal. We work a little harder to get along. And that helps us in social situations.
John, you were a science reporter here for a while, so you know a lot of studies that have been done, psychological studies, scientific studies. You hear this all the time, or I've read it many a time, that taller people get paid more, they're more likely to be CEOs, this kind of thing. Is that true?
It is true that there are studies that say on average this is the case. One of the things that I did as a science reporter and as an author was to look at those studies critically and to try to walk my readers through the studies and say, okay, what does this really mean? If taller people tend to earn more, what does that mean for you? And first of all, of course, I said these are averages, and who wants to be average? But also I went back to the researchers themselves and said, what does this mean for a short kid who comes across your study? And invariably, the authors of the study said, oh, no, no, no. One of the confounding factors here, for example, is that young people who are short, many of the people who are short in this study are small because of malnutrition, are small because they're disadvantaged. That, in fact, once you take out that factor, once you eliminate the people who are disadvantaged, then the disparity disappears. In another case, one of the researchers said, we're looking at kids who are 16, at the age of 16, and the growth spurt might come later, but we were looking at their later income and comparing it to the age of 16, their height at 16. And the correlation between height and income, height at that age and later income, suggests that it's not that you're being discriminated against. It's your own attitude. It's how you see yourself.
Do young kids today, the ages of 8 or 10, boys in particular, seem particularly self-conscious if they're unusually short?
Well, many kids see themselves as being wrong in some way. There's always something wrong with us. We're too short, or we're too tall, or we're too fat, or we're too skinny. Insecurity is sort of
atmospheric for a kid, especially during the years of conformity. But in fact, the evidence that kids who are small especially end up with serious psychological problems because of it, as opposed to irritation, just isn't there.
Thanks a lot, John.
You bet.
That's John Schwartz, whose new book, Short, Walking Tall When You're Not Tall at All, is reviewed in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, over on the fiction list, we've got some new blood, and I do mean blood. James Patterson is back on top with The Ninth Judgment. It's co-written with Maxine Pietro, one of his merry bands of co-authors, and it's about a detective who pursues a killer who's preying on women and children.
That's not new blood. That's recirculated blood.
Well, it's working. Down at number two, J.R. Ward enters with Lover Mine. It's book eight of the Black Dagger Brotherhood series. In case you're not up on that, it's paranormal vampire romance. Think vampires meets Kama Sutra. Fun, fun, fun.
As soon as I finish Remembrance of Things Past, that's next on my list.
Yeah, you might want to slow down.
What about nonfiction?
Michael Lewis, back on top. Oh, no, he's still on top with The Big Short. It's his seventh week on the list. And Carol Burnett has gotten a nice little bump. Her memoir, This Time Together, moves up to number two. I wonder if she's kind of riding on the steam of this whole campaign to get her to host Saturday Night Live following Betty White's great success. But it's helping the book. Some interesting new titles. Wes Moore's book, The Other Wes Moore, enters at number five. The Wes Moore who wrote the book is a former Rhodes Scholar, combat veteran, White House fellow from Baltimore, who found out about this other guy named Wes Moore, who was also from Baltimore, who was serving a life sentence in prison. So we started up a correspondence with him and trying to figure out where they parted ways in life. So I'm really looking forward to The Other Sam Tannenhouse. That would be a really interesting book.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhouse.